Welcome to The Solutionists, the therapy session your workplace didn't know it needed.
Stick with us. We have problems to solve.
In today's episode of The Solutionists, we are digging into the productivity conundrum. Or in other words, the mess we start getting into if we stop being value-seeking. Now, we're having this conversation now because from the global context, the world is under a lot of pressure, particularly when it comes to the competitive landscape. We have a particularly competitive landscape we all have to fight for our place in at the moment. It's very much a kind of dog-eat-dog world out there, survival of the fittest, and this is largely driven by two macro trends we're all either victims or victors of. That's specifically of globalization on the one hand, which means that our talent pools are borderless, our competitors are borderless, our customers are borderless, and that means we have to compete with the best in the best, not just within our own national context, but actually within the entire global context too. And the other big macro change when it comes to increasing that competitive landscape is, of course, automation in general and artificial intelligence in particular. Because everyone who has a shareholder, a board, a budget to meet is looking for ways to cut their costs. Let's face it, most of the growth in our stock markets and GDP numbers is, well, largely, frankly, bullshit. It's largely driven by things like increases in money supply rather than increases in productivity. And of course, we see people falling behind all over the place. We see young people unable to find jobs. We see older people getting retrenched in their 40s and 50s and unable to get back into the career market. And this, of course, means that in a world where economic belts and budgets are tightening, people are looking to cut costs. And that includes, quite frankly, you. Whatever it is that you're doing, your customer, your shareholder is looking for a way to make sure that they can get more out of you and pay less for you. And that means that you have to start focusing on the actual value that you can deliver in this incredibly unpredictable and competitive and fast-paced operating context. So maybe, Sharon, you want to come in and tell us a bit about what's going on from your perspective, not just in the global context, but actually within actual boardrooms and businesses right now.
You've highlighted clearly that the world is under pressure, and really this produces a strong need for people to focus on business productivity and an intense expectation, I guess, from boards to make things more efficient and more effective, doing more with less. We see the global context shifting, how many organizations are leaving our country, for example, locally. But even more broadly, as you've mentioned, we see headlines on retrenchments all day, every day. Some people are saying it's due to AI, but the reality is what we should always have been doing in organizations is now becoming a big need because other people can do things bigger, better, faster, and cheaper. And so as a result, productivity is top of mind. And really, it's about trying to measure how much output we get for the inputs that we, you know, are providing. But it's a conundrum in that that definition is filled with bullshittery in of itself. So I don't know if you want to build on that before I go into some more detail around some of our examples.
I've already spoken about how so much of the numbers that we chase, that we use as proxies for productivity and progress, are horrifically flawed. Like from an economic perspective, I'm certainly not the first person to mention how GDP itself, that number that governs which countries get the investments and who's first in the global race, is so full of, as Sharon said, frankly, bullshit.
Bullshit.
Well, in the South African context, this is particularly important in that the GDP number is flawed in two ways. On the one hand, it overvalues busyness over productivity. So if we're just passing money around to each other at the moment, as Sharon and I record this, there's a lot of memes and jokes blowing around about how NVIDIA and the other tech companies are effectively propping up the entire US and perhaps even global economy just by passing money around to each other in a kind of circle jerk kind of a setup, right? And there's, of course, a wonderful story there that I'm certainly not the first person to say about two economists that drives this point forward about just how much of the number that's made up of our GDP is, quite frankly, shit. The story goes like this. Two economists are walking through a forest, and the one economist pokes the other one in the elbow and says, you see that piece of shit over there? If you eat it, I'll give you $100. And the economist thinks about it and thinks, $100 is not too bad. So he eats it. They keep on walking through the forest, and the economist, who's just swallowed the shit, finds another pile of shit and says, to the first economist, if you eat that pile of shit, I will give you $100 to try and get his own back. Which, of course, the first economist does, because economists like money. The two of them continue walking through the forest for a while, and the one pauses and says to the other, wait a minute, we just effectively achieved nothing. You gave me $100, I gave you the same $100. We both ended up neither better nor worse off, except we've both just eaten a pile of shit. And the second economist says, well, that's not true, because we added $200 of value to the GDP, which basically just tells you the basic state of how accounting arbitrage works and how much nonsense there is in the numbers that we literally govern our lives and our interest rates and our employment statistics upon. But on the other hand, our GDP also grossly undercounts the parts of our economy that aren't digitized, quantified, and frankly taxed. In South Africa, there's been a lot of research at the moment that's come out and shown us just how big our informal economy is. And it's an informal economy that's remaining hidden largely on purpose, where people who are making a lot of money in the cash economy don't really want to be formalized and become part of the GDP, because that'll mean they will be taxed and suddenly their income will reduce by 30 to 40, even 50%, depending on how well they are doing. By some estimates, I mean, our informal economy in Africa is a $1 trillion size market that is not reflected in our GDP numbers, which means these numbers that govern our lives are largely a fantasy and a fiction and a way of congratulating ourselves for things that don't add value, but also grossly undervaluing the things that really are driving real value for real people on the ground. And this, of course, scales. It's not just a global GDP issue. There's also very similar issues that are taking place in workplaces today, which, Sharon, of course, you know so much about. All these metrics that we chase that encourage bullshit rather than discourage it. And that, of course, reduce value when they should be praising and incentivizing it.
Agree, Bron. I think you've highlighted that the bullshit starts in the definition and beyond that in the search for numbers and benchmarks. I think we are overwhelmed by consulting houses making their money off of the confidence that they are believed to instill in C-suite leaders by giving them numbers, benchmarks, and suggestions that the C-suite, who, by the way, are paid to come up with these same suggestions, don't know how to do or do, but are too scared to go the road less traveled and need scapegoats to blame should it not work out. So I think the reality is that we are so obsessed with busyness versus outcome that we aren't noticing the work that is being done undercover that actually is the value-adding work, and instead are AI-fying or seeking to become digital first, which in the context you've just provided in the South African economy, no one wants to be digital first in the economy of $1 trillion. And so it's a little bit of a misnomer, right? Benchmarks are also very backward looking. And while attempting to look at similar industries and organizations, really don't take into consideration any of the core areas of work that we provide. Or the customer we are adding or attempting to add value to. So when we are so internally focused on our own benchmarks, our own numbers, what other banks, what other retailers, what other mining companies are doing from an efficiency and effectiveness point of view, we aren't asking the real questions around, well, what is the customer's value orientation likely to be? And even if it is costing slightly more, is it what they want? And if so, more value adding than our competitors. And so, you know, true exceptions don't yet exist, and benchmarks are about thinking and encouraging mediocrity for everyone to aim to be the same, which to me is counterproductive. So it doesn't take into consideration context, doesn't take into consideration customer, and quite frankly, perpetuate bullshit in the sense that we're not having real conversations about what is and isn't working. And I think, you know, the psychological safety angle comes into play. We have to justify our numbers. We have to justify our value. We have to justify our balance sheets. What those numbers, as you've said, can be twisted to provide is a non-real safety net to say that actually we are performing and quite frankly, we aren't. That's the bullshittery we face inside organizations every day.
But maybe you want to dive into that a bit. So we spoke in generally, but specifically, what are some of those metrics that are effectively carrots, some of the wrong carrots to run after? And what are some of the buzzwords that we also like to use to distract or to do the sleight of hands to distract our shareholders and our businesses and our customers from where we're not really creating value?
The first thing I think are productivity metrics that look at sort of HR or any other function, finance, whether it's sales to FTE ratios. I think those really stress me out. The numbers should not be the target, right? And I think what we do is we try to say, okay, well, how many HR to FTE people do we need, or finance to FTEs or risk to FTE ratios do we need? And without context and customer in the sort of real mix, we chase numbers that aren't necessarily in line with what it is we're trying to provide from a product and service point of view. And so practically, what does that mean? It means that, let's take HR to FTE ratios as an example. People will tell you that it can range anything from baseline of 1 to 150, which is kind of where people sort of sit today, 1 to 200. The median should be 1 to 350, and actually maybe at the top quartile we should be chasing 1 to 500. The reality is the new benchmark could be 1 to 6,000, because if we are digital and we are providing the right products and services as HR practitioners or finance practitioners, etc., we should be able to reduce those numbers significantly. And I'll use the finance example. As a supplier to many businesses, I have to flip invoices and we have to use these horrible procurement systems. I'll try not to name them in case we upset huge numbers of procurement and finance people. But we call this transformation we're on in organizations, how many of our listeners probably could laugh at me saying, you know, everyone wants to be digital first and we need to sort of scale AI and, you know, really become so cognizant of hyper automation in our organizations. And we, again, you asked me about the terminology, these are them, sort of, you know, become agile, which masks bad productivity. It's a plastic metaphor. You know, to your point the other day in our conversation about vectors and speed, you know, speed without direction goes nowhere, as to the point we constantly talk about. And I say, well, you know, let's take the finance example. I'm a supplier. I now, somebody raises a PO, I now have to confirm that the work and order have been done. And Sharon, who loves admin not, then accidentally puts the wrong invoice number against the wrong amount. And this particular supplier who is, client, has spent quite a lot of money on automating finance. And so, anyway, long story short, I had to, in order for them to reverse their GL, pay the money back that was paid to me, for them to pay me back again, because the system did not recognize that the attached invoice number that I put into the system and the attachment did not match. Now, what is the point of digitization and digital first and FTE ratios in the context of the bullshit work that all of this stuff creates is my big question. So, you know, we have this amazing fixation with minimal viable products and use cases, this terminology that says, let's automate something and show real productivity and efficiency gains. But because we're looking at such an isolated part of a process, or we start with a process first instead of the experience we're trying to create, what we automate has bullshit effects on multiple other processes or in different parts of our organizations. And quite frankly, we need to start thinking about experience as a holistic piece. Digital first, MVPs, use cases are dangerous, as are benchmarks, as a number to chase. We need to be chasing the outcome we are trying to achieve. And that is where we can avoid value extraction and become value seeking.
Adding more processes into your daily grind for your employees or for your organization doesn't increase your productivity. I think my favorite ones, they have to be around all those sort of productivity apps that we had like a great bubble in a few years ago, like in the pre-COVID days, where everyone was looking for ways to be more productive, and their productivity tool suites, whether it was for an individual entrepreneur or for an organization, took more time to manage than the tasks that they were trying to make more efficient really did, right? I mean, if you just think about how we manage our meetings or manage our day-to-day tasks, when we try and like turn that into another process, then if it takes longer to capture the action into the process generating system than it takes to actually just do that action, we really are just creating work for no reason. And I think you make really good points there around the whole automation of unproductivity, things that work fast but get us nowhere, things that just increase volume and speed, but speed of stuff that no one needed in the first place.
Exactly. And the number of PowerPoint presentations people are producing for excos, committees, subcommittees of boards, because they're required in a particular template to be sent so many days before at whatever particular time, you know, within so many pages. And yes, they are read, but the underlying causes of some of these things are not brought to the fore. We are not interrogating or having real conversations through these limitations. We should be shifting excos and committees to decision-making orientation and to having real conversations, and in fact, highlighting bullshit to be solved for, as opposed to trying to paint this pretty picture of how rosy everything always is. You know, that's not solving real problems on a day-to-day. You know, I'm consistently sort of awed by people who are like, you know, we're giving co-pilot license to everybody in the organization, and it's so expensive, but it's going to make things so much more efficient. I don't know if you've ever used co-pilot to do your minutes on Teams, but quite frankly, it doesn't necessarily capture context or insight around, you know, some of the things that are happening, and we have to rewrite them anyway. So is all of this money we are spending on tools, all of this encouragement to tell people to leverage AI in their jobs in the wrong way, not adding cost versus, you know, creating value? Similarly on, you know, technologies, and we'll talk about a tech case study just now, but the biggest gap and investment we need to start to make is on integration and middleware, and not on the front-facing technologies that are, you know, claiming to be able to increase efficiency and effectiveness everywhere and, you know, replace jobs. The reality is that these individual pieces that aren't knitted neatly together are doing dodgy things. So if the person who's programming the screening tools isn't clear on, you know, how to ask questions, for example. So if I say to you, Bron, here's a job in finance, you have to sort of answer some questions to get through the screening flow. And that question might say, are you FICA qualified for a bank or whatever the case may be? You just say yes. But there's no real knowledge or skill around, you know, whether it can't intuit that you weren't. So, we basically are bullshitting each other. Systems that are don't have the core identifiers or business rules programmed into them, like recruitment, not using ID numbers means that you can have 40 email addresses and the same recruiter is literally bouncing the same CV around over and over and over again. The real knowledge and skills, understanding what people are actually doing, where is that inefficiency lying? And we're not interrogating those things through automation. So we'll automate the fact that the unique identifier is an email address. We're not interrogating how much bullshittery is in the original process and taking it out. And then how that might link to multiple other processes that need to, you know, at the end of the day, we are so focused on minimal viable products and use cases and these individual tiny little things. We're not looking at the system. And then we're not looking at the outcome for the customer.
You make a very good point with the system there, and that's got something that I've been thinking about to bring to the fore, and that is this concept that I'm calling productivity arbitrage, which is something I see with automation and productivity tools, especially coming back to our conversation around metrics.
Yes.
If your KPIs are encouraging you to reduce time and increase efficiency based on some arbitrary metric, and you find some AI tool to help you meet those metrics, you can end up passing on the actual work, the time, the conflict to someone else, often further up the organogram chart.
Or your customer even worse.
Or down to your customer, yeah, where it actually hurts more. And your example around minutes is a great one to show exactly what that is. So the person who's taking notes at the minutes wants to get that job done as quickly as possible, so they get AI to do it for them. However, those cruddy minutes get passed up to their manager, who has to rewrite them. Now using someone at a higher pay grade who costs more to both your company and your customer to take on that task. That's the productivity arbitrage. Or you pass it down to your customer, something that reduces time for you but increases frustration to your customer. So we all think we're doing a good job because we're meeting our productivity metrics. We're not thinking systemically about the bigger picture because we've been incentivized to atomize and focus on our own lunch without figuring out what our value in the value chain is. And I know you've got great examples with banks there on that productivity arbitrage, sending the pain and the friction to your customer but taking it off your plate so you can tick that box and meet that metric.
And at the end of the day, not deliver to the customer at all and really just cause frustration. I think the reality is that we have to start to think about the experiences we are trying to create holistically and evaluate all the processes that are going into that experiences collectively. And while you might implement in minimum viable product, you know, decide that we're going to do this first, that first, second, etc., it is not, you know, agile is not a replacement for not thinking. It is not a replacement for not having a vision or a plan. It is not we are so obsessed with, okay, well, here's the report. We said we were going to do, you know, these tickets from Jira. If any of you work on Jira, I'm sure you're all vomiting right now because we all know that Confluence, Jira, all of these things have added so much pain in our lives and they must be tracked. But the real concept of, are we delivering the right code, is not measured. We're delivering code and we're delivering it at a rate of XYZ, whatever. We measured on run rates. We even internally charge each other for the work that we do, even though we're getting a salary anyway. All these wooden Chinese dollars that get floated around inside transfer pricing in organizations. But we actually haven't identified the real problem we're trying to solve, and that is an art. And we have to start to think a lot more commercially around the money we're spending and the, you know, outputs we are achieving. And efficiency and effectiveness aren't the starting point. Experience has to be. Otherwise, we really are just wasting money all day everywhere. Like the economists passing bullshit on to each other.
And calling it GDP.
And calling it GDP, exactly.
Very funny. But Sharon, we're not being particularly honest. We do bill ourselves as the solutionists. This is supposed to be a solutionist podcast, and we've spent the last 20 minutes talking about the problem. But in order to fulfill our promise and add our value to our listeners, thank you for sticking with us so long. We also need to get into the solutions.
Agreed.
And some of the best ways to do this is through case studies.
Yeah.
And Sharon, this is what you've done. You're coming with real experience, with real stories, which we have anonymized to protect all the individuals involved. And of course, what we'd love to hear from you is, if you are listening to this, if you've got a problem that you're too shy to speak up about in your organization for political or career preservation reasons, get in touch with us at survivetheaiapocalypse.com, and we can certainly make sure that we can try to solve your problems too. But for today, we're trying to solve, or at least give some pointers towards solving, the issue of this productivity conundrum and how we shift from chasing productivity and metrics towards delivering performance
value,
and value, ultimately. So Sharon, what are some of those case studies that you've got your hands dirty with and then cleaned up?
I'll focus on one in particular, I think, because it's quite a useful and practical one to be able to illustrate our points. And it involved the changing of the tech organization in a large financial services institution. many of which are federated. And for those listening, federation often means that the individual businesses within the larger organization are run independently with their own independent balance sheets. And what that often means is that decision making, et cetera, happens in those silos independently. And, you know, again, what often we are told the problems are often not the problems. So what we wouldn't do is go and speak to people. You know, actually look at real examples, real screens, look at the work that people are doing. And so in this particular case, we identified a number of issues. And the problem and the outcome wasn't to sort of restructure and transform for the sake of reducing headcount. And I think whenever, you know, I'm told we need to reduce headcount, I kind of go, do we, don't we? Is that really the outcome we're trying to achieve? Yes, saving and commercial viability of any particular program you run has to be an outcome. But to really understand the root cause, we have to make sure we're not looking at symptoms. And so in this particular case, some of the things that were happening, and in technology organizations, it's not uncommon to have half of your population be contractors. When it is a problem is when critical capabilities are being outsourced and the business is being held ransom by outsourced providers because these skills don't exist internally. And then remember the downstream processes of skills development and, you know, building capability ahead of demand are not running in the way that they should. So you can't actually even measure what you have internally versus what you don't. There's often a lot of duplication and overlap in federated organizations. And outsourced providers, by the way, love this because they can go and sell a brief to business one, business two, business three, business four, doing the same thing over and over again, selling it over and over again. And we pay an absolute fortune for it. The teams themselves were structured against specific technologies in this case. So if you were someone who worked on SAP, then there was a SAP team. If you were someone, and what we really see in cases like that is that there's no integration in between technologies. And we're seeing more and more that with AI and the real sort of focus on data cleansing, you know, really understanding the full data layer of a tech stack, is that that is critical for anything else to work. And so what we do is we divert attention from sort of the data layer as well as the integration layer by really structuring people around technical expertise, which in many instances is a shift we need to make. And so what we did was we said, okay, cool, let's first see if everyone has the same view of the problem, which of course is never the case. And said, okay, if we were to be really clear on what gets delivered, every business is going to do customized and nuanced stuff because their stacks are different, and that's absolutely fine. That piece businesses should control, right? They know who their end customer is. But the reality is in something like a bank, one customer could be served by multiple business units. So you might be have family banking, but you might have business banking. You might also have a home loan. You might also have vehicle asset finance. And what's super interesting is you get offered a loan, you know, here, click in the app and you've got an automated credit of 50,000 bucks based on your history and you guys are amazing. And then you go and apply for a business loan for 100,000 and they go, no. And you're like, but you just gave me 50 in my personal capacity. Now you're saying no in my business capacity, because we're not looking at the customer end to end and what it is we're providing. So if we're saying we want to provide, I don't know, growth resources or whatever the case may be, or we want to, in the HR case for the HR stack, instead of saying we are SAP, which runs across finance, HR, etc., we've got to say we need a team that can look at enterprise planning. And enterprise planning might have 50 different technologies. The reality is those processes have to connect for it to be effective and efficient. And so what we did was really looked at what we needed to be really, really good at. We redefined the value chain to say if this is kind of the product and service we need to provide, which is enterprise resource planning, what is that outcome for the business and or our customers, and therefore what would the teams be that we have underneath them. So we agreed key principles for success, like we shouldn't be queuing to get work done. So, you know, normally in a, agile process, you'll go through these sprint planning sessions and everyone will go like, we only have so much capacity, so whatever gets sprinted first gets sprinted first. And that necessarily, if you aren't really clear on the full outcome of what it is you're delivering, what you end up potentially having is a whole bunch of people waiting in a queue in a line. And really, one of the outcomes for this transformation was, well, how do we ensure that people can code into Rails that allows freedom to be able to deliver products and services super quickly, but within a framework? And so understanding what those rails are, where they connect, how they connect is super, super, super important. So some of the principles were no queuing, being independent enough to be able to code with, you know, within the rails. There's certain core capabilities like security, et cetera, that have to be set up for a full organization, but they also can't be the ones that hold us back. And so all of those principles were agreed. And I think the reality is that when you're doing a transformation, fact-based information is super important because it is very emotional. And what we try to do is to help organizations think through, well, how do you do this as a matter of course so that it becomes the right thing? So if you off the bat are measuring the wrong metrics, what you need to be able to do at the end of a transformation is have the new ones that give you the data to continuously change and to reprogram your systems on a day-to-day basis. And when I say reprogram your systems, I mean your full system, people, process, tech, the whole piece. So once those principles were agreed, and by the way, that was not easy. I was told to F off. I had doors slammed in my face. You know, we federated. We own our own businesses. Stuff you. Who do you think you are? But once those principles are agreed and there's data to back it up, and this is where the bullshitometer for organizations comes from, right? Is that diagnostic around, you know, we started to find that of the 5,000 people that happened to be in this organization, 500 were managers. That's like a 1-10 ratio. Okay, what are the managers doing? When we started uncovering what the skills were that the managers had, well, they weren't technical people at all. What they really were relationship managers and go-betweens, because if you needed the mainframe, but you came from business 10 and the mainframe's only in business 1, you need a broker to try and get space to be able to code into that area or deploy a piece of tech in that area that requires those mainframe resources. And so what you've got is this, you know, situation in organizations in which the managers themselves weren't technical but relationship oriented. So one of the principles was, we need people who can lead like technical work. Okay, so well, how are we going to get that done? And therefore, what needs to change in the bureaucracy that sits in someone being able to deploy something without asking for permission and having to queue in this mainframe queue? Anyway, it's a, you know, guys, I'm not a techie, so for those listening, please don't judge my technical capabilities. But the point being, what we then did was say, okay, if we were going to do that, what do people need to be super hot at? And I know a lot of techies will argue with me and say, well, full stack engineering is not possible. And I'm like, maybe not in one person, but you can set your DevOps up in such a way that you can deliver an end-to-end solution if you need to. And if you are geared against a product like resource planning or like servicing or like whatever the case may be, so your stack isn't determined by the name technology, but by the outcome it is meant to achieve. And therefore you know, collect teams against the work to be done to achieve that outcome, and it's doable. There's, you know, the reality is then that we started to assess, is it true then that one of the problems people had told us was, an issue is that there's a whole bunch of planning stuff that happens and you have to do. There's business as usual work that has to happen anyway because you've got to do maintenance. You've got to, you know, change the switches in the data center. You've got to do what you got to do, right? So there's that stuff. And we started to look at the actual work to be done. And we said, okay, cool. So here's maintenance orientated work. It's business as usual. This work here is kind of design orientated. It's very solution orientated. We need the right DevOps capability to be able to get us the right outcomes. This work here is wish list stuff. It's all the nice to haves. And actually, it's not really a priority linked to strategy, which is a big other finding, right, is what work do we absolutely have to do? What should we do and for us to be able to be profitable? And to be really clear on that, the ability to plan outside of silos, linked to a strategic plan that says, here are the few things we have to do and do really, really well. And everyone's like, oh, we're so understaffed. So we decided, cool, let's now do a book of work review. And we assessed things on two bases. One was around skills and one was around the actual work to be done and the deployed resources in that work. And what we found was actually we were overstaffed. The reality was that very few people were being overstretched, while there were many others doing little pieces of sort of, what is the word, unique skilled items that aren't able to code in a full stack environment that are required, but not at full capacity. So when you look at that, you go, these oaks are about to fall over and have heart attacks. And many of them, by the way, practically and realistically do. You know, there are lots of these cases, especially in techie environments. And a whole bunch of people that are doing things absolutely necessary, can't let them go. The skill is absolutely unique because it's a legacy piece of tech. No one else can do it. Then you look at the recruitment process. Remember I said 50% contractors of the recruited contractors and realize they're held to a very different standard, right? Because they're coming in from outsourced providers, third parties, etc. And if we've defined these new skills, these skills of the future that we need in this, you know, full stack orientation, the ability to solution differently, it's not just about coding, it's about being able to translate solutions. The typical and old-fashioned business analyst has to be able to create and ideate a solution that makes sense, that integrates, that considers front end all the way to back end, which is quite different in thinking and facilitation of solutioning to what we've had in the past. Then how do these peeps just come on board because the outsource provider said, come on board? And when we assessed their skills, realized that, whoa, these peeps don't even have the skills we needed internally, and so we had to let half the contractors go. Anyway, the reality being that through that, we were able to then size teams. And yes, you will never have a full complement of permanent individuals. You'll always have to scale up and down depending on the state of the business, new product, you know, launches, whatever the hell's coming in from regulation. But the concept of being able to look at what is it we're driving, why are we driving it, how do we consolidate our teams with the right skills to deliver, where are certain things owned, and even if they are centralized, how do we ensure that we are not debilitating our individual businesses in a federated organization? I always say structure doesn't really matter if we're adults. It shouldn't matter where I report or who I talk to or where I sit. You know, if we were hiring right, if we were managing people against outcomes, whether they are collective or individual, you know, we wouldn't be so besotted with things like processes for performance management. You know, like it always freaks me out. Someone's not performing and we, you know, talk about how horrific it is to manage them. And I go, well, you know, did the manager hire the right person in the first place and were they fired? Why are we talking about the poor performer? And who's the real poor performer here anyway? Anyway, that's going to take me down a side show and soapbox. So let me hand over to you, Bron. I don't know if you have any questions on that particular example, but it is a real case study and it's one that is super important.
Well, it does kind of lead on to the questions around benchmarks, because productivity, the challenges are about tethering ourselves to chasing incorrect or correct numbers. And usually, as you're saying, they're flawed. They're flawed in our judgments. And when it comes to benchmarks, I think the best way to describe what's broken is at the end of the Back to the Future movie, which came out in the 1980s, of course, they say, where are we headed? There are no roads. And that, of course, is it, right? Because benchmarks are based on past performance, either our own or someone else's. But we're headed to the future. There are no benchmarks for the future. We've got to create it as we get there. So if we are tethering ourselves to performance metrics that are not going to be relevant in a change context, we're not doing ourselves or anyone any favors, and we should not be congratulating ourselves for meeting these benchmarks that are effectively meaningless. So I know benchmarks are a big bugbear of yours. Maybe you want to just go into that a little bit, and if you've got any examples to illustrate. But the point being, if you're aiming towards a number that is fundamentally meaningless, we're spinning our wheels. We're not going anywhere.
Agreed. And so in this particular example, if this existing organization had been in a benchmark report of all the financial services institutions by some of those big five companies that tell you, here, this is the average tech to FTE ratio or tech-orientated or digitization or whatever, infrastructure resources versus DevOps resources versus data resources, we would be benchmarking against something that was already inefficient and ineffective to begin with. And so that is my big bugbear, is that we have to shift the conversation and the metric. And, you know, in our book, we write about Steinhoff and Tongaat Hewlett and all of those other businesses that crashed. You know, to the boards, they were doing phenomenally well. But where was the conversation about what was actually going on? Because numbers and benchmarks can be manipulated. And the reality is that we have to start holding ourselves accountable for ongoing transformation. And you can only do that if your data is accurate. You need to understand what the work is people are doing. So, you know, the person who's spending hours and hours and hours on a call with a customer to solve an issue is probably generating you more value than the metric you've probably got in place that says you've got to do 20 customers a day, 10 minutes, a customer, or whatever the case may be. And we have to really consider that. Yes, we've changed banking branches and we have huge real estate costs. We still want a physical footprint because of the fact that physical infrastructure is very difficult to get hold of. But when people come in, they are now forced to work or interact digitally. When we know that the majority of our consumers, although all of them have a cell phone, don't want to be known. They want to deal in cash. And you know, I get that we will end up going cashless, and I'm not saying that's a bad strategy. I'm just saying the numbers and the benchmarks we're using aren't necessarily the numbers and the benchmarks our customers are using to evaluate whether they are getting value from us for the amount they're paying. And what we are doing with these benchmarks is adding a whole bunch of cost into processes and systems that at the end of the day are going to be transferred to our clients.
Starting from that thesis that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that what gets measured gets manipulated, how can businesses then shift from productivity chasing based on flawed numbers towards actually being productive?
I'm going to go back to data. We know that AI, automation, all of that stuff cannot work if your data layer isn't accurate. And it needs to be something that is interrogated, and the people balance sheet, which doesn't exist, needs to be something that comes into play. We cannot look at pieces of things in isolation. We have to start thinking about the experience we want for our employees, as well as the experience we want for the customer, and whether those two things marry. Take the example of seniority, which is often a segmentation lens. You know, senior people get extra leave, or they get the parking bay, or they get the office with a door as opposed to this open plan environment that people are working in all day, every day. And if their computer busts because of their cost to company, right, which for every hour is huge, they get VIP treatment, which makes sense because they cost a lot of money. And if they can't use their computers and they can't work, well, it's going to cost us a lot of money. But then there's a dude who's in front of a customer whose computer goes down. They don't have laptops. They've got a shared desktop. They don't have access to VIPs, et cetera, et cetera. They wait 2 or 3 days. Customer leaves, maybe goes and opens an account at the next place, which happens to be in the same area in the mall anyway. The reality is we need to start to think differently about who we are servicing and who is servicing those people as our workforce, and how we start to deliver impact through that experience and measure efficiency and effectiveness differently. And I think I'm not saying any of the buzzwords that we attacked today, like agile or MVPs or use cases, are inherently wrong. I'm saying that outside of the context of understanding experience and outcome, those individual things are not likely to give you the outcome you're looking for. And so we have to start our planning processes and our strategic orientation differently. We have to start to interrogate decision-making practices, all of those things that lead to decisions on investment, for example. We make those decisions in silos often. you know, and we need to shift actual behavior through practice. How are we budgeting, for example? You know, how are we determining the transfer pricing on a commercial asset? How are we making the decision in the boardroom around what goes first, second, and third? Is it in a finance forum for finance or an HR forum for HR? Or is it in the context of the bigger strategic plan? What are the conversations we are having, and are we having real ones? And do we have the data to back it up? Do we know who our people are, what they're working on? The reality is the people working on things know where the inefficiency, the experience gaps, the effectiveness gaps are. And we are making assumptions sometimes on what those things are, and the real values being masked in our organizations. And I think I've given you a very roundabout answer, but the reality is we need to start to be a lot more mindful and deliberate about the actions we take, and it starts with our data sets. Do you know how many people you have, what they're doing, at what level, in what format, where they connect to the value chain, if there's a direct impact or not on the customer, how far away they are from the customer, how many managers do you have? That is the data that really will help you to succeed.
So to kind of sum up everything we've said today, we have taken you on a bit of a journey from forests with economists all the way through to the bowels of the dirt collecting in the financial system. But ultimately, what you're really saying is that productivity should not be placed on a pedestal when it comes down to the metrics. It's not, as you say, a solo player. It needs to be approached in context. And yeah, I don't know if you've got any closing words there, Sharon, to wrap this up, but that's really the thing, that we can't chase the number. We have to be focused on the goal. And the numbers are just means, and they might not even be the best means to get us towards that goal. We need to keep our eyes on the prize. The prize, of course, being what is the actual value that we're trying to deliver here in the end.
I think so. And I think also to journey with a team versus to give a productivity mandate out to an exco, for example, is so important. And when you start with a number, you start with fear. You start with, you know, we're going to cut heads, we're going to reduce costs, we, you know, are in a bind and everybody must rally around the bind, which inevitably gives people kind of the focus on protecting, you know, sort of their domain and their roles versus being able to solve. And I think when you start the conversation with experience, where are the opportunities we have to improve these things over and above our competitors? If customers were to evaluate us, what would they want to see as opposed to shiny new toys or any of those things? You know, the focus becomes something completely different. And, yeah, benchmarks are useful to convince boards to say, you see, we told you there's a problem, but they aren't necessarily right. They're not right for your strategy or your customer. And they're not necessarily as far as you can go because, quite frankly, they're on the past. They're not really forward folks. So, yes.
There you have it. Today's problem solved. Join us again for the next episode of The Solutionists, where we'll be getting into a different conundrum. Next time, we'll be diving into projects and programs and what businesses all over the place are getting wrong and how we can help you do a bit better. Thank you for joining us for this therapy session. We'll see you soon with more solutions. Thank you for joining us for today's corporate therapy session. If you want The Solutionists to solve a workplace dilemma with you, contact us at survivetheaiapocalypse.com.
Welcome to The Solutionist Movement.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.